Welcome, my friends, to the Sage Akwe Radio Hour, your home for free and critical thinking, and I'm your host, Mike Williams. Tonight, my special guest is Mr. James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com. James is one of the preeminent researchers and critical thinkers in the alternative research community today. Our discussion was wide-ranging as we talked through how the puppet masters work to keep the alternative media off balance, which led us into what Edward Snowden and his revelations really mean, and then wrapping up with James giving his insights on a de-dollarization being pursued by the BRICS alliance led by Russia. To kick our discussion off, I asked James to tell us how he got started and what keeps him motivated. Let's take a listen.
Well, I guess how I got started with the research is back in 2006 when I first started encountering some of this information online. And basically, I had just recently moved into a new apartment here in Japan, and I was and this new apartment came with an internet connection. And it was the first time in years that I'd had an internet connection right there in my home. And in the intervening time there, I had missed out on all sorts of new things that were developing online, like Google Video and YouTube and things like this. And so that was pretty important for me, because when I started to discover this, it was kind of like a dream come true in some ways. I could suddenly research whatever I wanted and see whatever I wanted whenever I wanted it. And coming, of course, from my childhood background of having, you know, television station network programmers deciding what I should watch and when I should watch it, It was definitely something, just a different paradigm, and I started to use it to basically explore subjects within my own realm of research at the time, which, of course, I mean, I was interested in politics, but very much from the left-right kind of political perspective, very much within the system. And being a good Canadian boy, I was very much interested in basically the left side of that argument, so I followed, you know, the Daily Show and things like that. And it was through that I actually started to encounter, in the related videos section of the YouTube videos, I started to encounter information about 9/11 truth. And it was interesting because that was a subject that I had for years resisted any thought or mention of. And so I didn't want to look at it. Oh, you know, that's just disrespectful. I know some things are conspiracies. I don't believe the JFK assassination myth, but that's just going too far. But I clicked on some of them out of curiosity, and some of the videos that I watched were just silly and I, you know, didn't teach me anything, but others were interesting and they intrigued me enough to begin researching it on my own. So basically one thing led to another, and as I'm sure many of your listeners can relate to, I started going further and further down that rabbit hole, chasing some of these trails that I found, wow, I can actually find information to back some of this stuff up. What's going on here? And it started to really call into question some of the things that I had believed up to that point. But then there came a point at which I thought, well, this can't possibly, I mean, it looks like there's something going on here, but it just can't possibly be this way. How could this function? How could government be that compromised? And it was when I watched The Money Masters, which is an excellent, for anyone who hasn't watched, it's a very lengthy, very detailed documentary, but very, very, very in-depth in terms of how the money system came to be created, and specifically in the United States. And once you realize that money itself is basically an illusion that's created by the banks for profit, for their own personal profit, out of nothing, you start to get the sense that, oh yeah, this system really can be manipulated top to bottom. So then that's when I started to get seriously into this. And the website just came about spontaneously as a result of that. I mean, I really felt that I had to start getting this information out to other people. And really one of the first things I hit on was, well, I guess I'll do a website. And it was weird because I'd never in my entire life imagined that I would ever start a website. But there I was suddenly teaching myself how to do podcasting and all of this. And it's been a long and sometimes arduous process, but here I am after all these years. So I hope that story motivates other people, because really I have no special training, no special access to any special sources of information or anything of that sort. I just stumbled into this completely on my own. And if I'm able to do this, I really do think pretty much anyone in the audience is able to as well. And I hope they do, because again, it's so important to get this information out to other people. If we just sit on it for ourselves, what does it really benefit anyone? So I always try to think that my experience is really just that of a canary in the coal mine, showing other people that it can be done.
Now, James, you have a very even-keeled approach to your presenting and your work, and I think that is very key to your ability to get your message out. And I don't mean to disparage others who are in the alternative media and their styles, because everybody has their niche, but your approach is unique in many ways. And because of the way you bring it forth, I can send your links and your clips to folks that perhaps might not normally listen to this type of material. But because of the way you present it, they do listen. And when you listen, you learn. And the reason why I bring this up is because this is exactly how I got drawn to your work.
Well, I appreciate that feedback. And of course, I'm always happy to hear that. And I don't take that lightly. I mean, certainly I've heard that feedback from other people. So I do appreciate hearing about that. But I also always think, well, there are other people out there who do not respond to my style. And I think that everybody has their own style of not only presenting, but also receiving information, and everyone looks for something different. And so I don't posit myself as, you know, the be all and end all of anything. I'm just one more guy out there who's putting it out in my own way. And I think people respond at the end of the day to authenticity. If I was out there trying to be that kind of bombastic, abrasive, over the top person, it would be ridiculous. And people, I think, would see through it because that's just not who I am. Instead, I'm this even keeled kind of guy, and that's just who I am. So I think my work reflects that, and I think people respond to the authenticity of that. And hopefully, yes, I mean, one of the entire reasons for me starting the website and doing it the way I do is because I thought, well, there's so much information out there, but when you listen to one of these, you know, Patriot radio shows or the types of things that I was listening to when I first got into this, I was always somewhat frustrated. I mean, not frustrated, but I would hear something interesting and then I'd go online and look it up and I'd find documentation for it. And I always thought, well, here we are in the internet age. Why don't we just put this together? So that's something that it's always been a part of my work. I've always tried to link people back to the source documents so that they can look it up for themselves. Because at the end of the day, I think that's the most convincing. You can tell people till you're blue in the face about these things, but until they actually start to look it up for themselves, I don't think they'll ever really fully take it on board.
Well, you're an empowering voice, James, and you're certainly waking a lot of people up. I do have a question for you, though, James, to basically maybe jump into some of the topics here tonight. To me, it certainly appears that those of us that prefer critical thinking, that we are living in, how would I say, some parallel universe and watching some really bad actors in the theater of the absurd. So I was wondering if you could share your perspective on how events are used by the puppet masters to keep the alternative media and the resistance movement in react mode versus perhaps being proactive. Because the rate and pace of how these events are being rolled out, in my view, is extraordinary. You know, to pick some examples, what I'm referring to, some recent events like the Bo Bergdahl Taliban prisoner exchange or the Nevada cop shooting by that fellow Jared Miller. And then we have the chaotic border situation down in Arizona and the terrorism that's currently underway in Iraq. And I guess we could probably even throw the Ukraine into the mix. How are those events put together to create obstacles and to keep the alternative media and the resistance movement off balance?
Well, this is such an important topic because I've been someone who's been very much a cheerleader for the alternative media movement in general since I first started getting into it, because I think it is so important what's happening right now and the fact that we do have access to these technologies that make conversations like this one halfway around the world completely possible. And it sounds like we're talking in the same room. I mean, it is a pretty amazing age to be living in, just from that perspective alone, let alone the fact that, of course, that opens up the possibility of people collaborating in a kind of crowdsourcing effort to try to find the truth. And that's, I mean, again, it's extremely exciting. And there's so many positive things that can come from this. One of them I always point to, of course, is the fact that just a few years ago, the idea of false flag terrorism was basically completely alien to most people. And you really had to explain to them, well, why would the government attack itself? And now false flag has entered into the general discourse and into the lingo. And most people at least have heard of the concept now. That is something. I mean, that's maybe not the be all and end all, and it's not going to solve all our problems, but it is something. And it is some sort of progress towards a greater and more nuanced understanding of the world, which is, I think, part of what we're trying to achieve, because we've been railroaded for so long into false war after false war and all of the other lies that we live our lives through because we don't have information about some of these basic concepts. So having said all that, I mean, I do think the alternative media is having a profound effect and a largely good effect in a lot of different ways. But I also worry about the way that things are going now. And maybe I have a different perspective on this because I'm a Canadian living here in Japan, so I have maybe a little bit of distance on this, but I see so many of these stories that float across the newswire that become the biggest story ever. not only in the mainstream, but then also in the alternative media. And I could look back at all sorts of different incidents that seemed like the biggest thing in the world, and people would write to me, why aren't you covering this? It's, you know, this is the biggest story right now. And I just try to keep my perspective on stories like that and wonder, you know, I mean, 9/11, yeah, we're talking about that 12 years later. We'll probably be talking about it 12 years from now. But a lot of these events, 12 years from now, people probably won't even remember the names of the people involved. So I try to keep it in that perspective because I think we run the risk of allowing the mainstream media to, and whatever, you know, forces and powers are behind that, the agenda that's reflected there, to steer the alternative media. And simply by making this or that event into the biggest story of the moment, and then all of the alt media piles on to do the alt media analysis, and maybe there, yeah, I'm not saying there's no value in that. Of course, we have to dissect and show the propaganda for what it is, but it means that the alt media is constantly in reaction mode, so that and in a way it feeds into the fear porn paranoia loop that the mainstream media tries to put out there. Part of what they're trying to do is to make this or that particular incident, this or that, you know, mass shooting or whatever, into something that everybody is talking about, because that conversation in itself helps along the agenda. If the alt media were using its power rather than simply just reacting to all these events that come along, I think there would be more of an attempt to actually set the agenda of the social discourse through the alt media rather than to simply report on what the mainstream media is reporting on. And I'm seeing this, for example, myself and James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com, we do a weekly video news series called New World Next Week that comes out every Thursday. And a segment that we've added in recent months and that we're going to continue doing, because I think it is so valuable to do, is called Good News Next Week, where we try to focus on some of the positive things that are happening that the mainstream media will never ever make the main big story of the moment that we all have to be talking about. And whether it's something as simple as a community garden or a community banning GMOs or something of that nature, whether it's something that simple or it's a bigger, more profound thing about some, you know, alternative energy or whatever it is, I think that there's so much happening in the world that isn't talked about because even presenting some of these ideas is a detriment to the power structure that exists. And I think that the alt media's real shining moment, if and when it ever comes, is when it stops simply reacting to the events that are being reported in the mainstream media and starts setting its own agenda of what to positively promote as the alternative structures that will be, I think, the structures that will, if anything, will see us through these times. Because at the end of the day, it's not what's happening in this or that particular incident. It's what's going to emerge on the other side. And we already know exactly what they're trying to steer us into. We know that there is the plan for the gradual consolidation of power up through the regional level, eventually to the global governmental level, and that all of these little incidents serve as stepping stones along the way toward that, because it gets us into the kinds of conversations that they can very easily steer. And they can control the conversation in that way. So I recognize there is value to talking about what the big story of the moment is and to dissecting that type of propaganda. But I just wish there were more sources, alt media sources out there, that were trying to set a different agenda and trying to more positively show some of the things that are going on that they don't want us to be looking at, rather than focusing on the things they do want us to be looking at.
Well, what are some of those things, James, that we should be looking at that they're trying to keep us from looking at?
I think anything in which people are able to take power into their own hands rather than waiting for some sort of political savior through the political system, or waiting for some alt media savior or whoever it is, someone out there to come along from the sky and hand us some victory on a platter. I think we can be caught in that narrative, which again I think is pumped out through the mainstream media, specifically through Hollywood conditioning and programming, to expect that, you know, there's going to be some Rambo to come along that will set everything straight, or that this will all end in some hot martial law scenario and we'll all go Red Dawn and, you know, and manage to root out the enemy or something. I think that what we're undergoing is a generational process of conditioning to get us to desire our own enslavement, which sounds ridiculous until you actually see it happening. So I think that the positive stories that counteract that are stories that show that there are possibilities for for taking some of this power into her own hands and not relying on the existing economic or political structures. And one story that I've been pointing to recently, maybe it's not as important as it would seem. I keep pointing to this story. I think it's not the be-all and end-all of this, but I keep pointing to this story of this German village that called Lowenstedt. It's just a small little rural village that doesn't have any particular big industry or any large population. They're just kind of a rural village in the middle of nowhere that there was some internet. Basically, no telecom provider wants to run broadband internet into there because it just doesn't make any economic sense for them. There's not enough people. The infrastructure would be too expensive. So the town basically got together and created their own broadband network, and as a result, they now have some of the fastest internet speeds in Germany. And that's the type of story I like, not necessarily because this, again, is the be-all and end-all of what's possible, but because it shows once again that when people work together, we're so often locked into this mindset that we need to have, you know, we need to have a government come along and make a law for the telecoms to run broadband into every village or something. That's the only way this could be solved, as opposed to just going out there and actually doing it. And I know it's a lot harder to do that, but I think at the end of the day, it's obviously much better if we can band together as a community to do something voluntarily and acknowledging and understanding the importance of what's being done, because that type of infrastructure that's created from the ground up is inherently more stable than some sort of top-down imposed authoritarian structure can ever be. Because when we cede the power to government to make a law, for example, to make net neutrality the law of the land so that no telecom provider can violate net neutrality, what we're also doing is tacitly saying, yes, the government gets to decide this. This isn't something that we have control over. This isn't something that we, at the end of the day, get to say to the telecoms providers, no, we won't take your net neutrality violating service. It's something that the government gets to rule on. And of course, if the government gets to rule on it, yes, today they might rule in net neutrality, and tomorrow they might rule to violate that. And we've ceded the argument simply by allowing the FCC or whatever type of governmental organization to come along and decide it. So I think that there are exciting things happening, especially in technological fields that already exist to a large extent. I've talked, for example, on my program about a pirate internet and the idea of getting around the existing internet infrastructure, which we know was created by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. It was originally the ARPANET. It is part of the U.S. Infrastructure. I mean, the U.S. government still controls much of the infrastructure of the internet. And of course, all the traffic that runs through the U.S. is being scooped up and collected and analyzed wholesale, despite whatever the latest Snowden quote-unquote revelation is. We know that content is being completely snarfed up and stored in the Utah data center that they have up and running now. So we need a way off of this. And rather than trying to put in some new law that is supposedly going to tie the hands of the NSA, because we know that they're such law-abiding people, right? I think that the real answer is going to come from us saying, no, well, we don't want this system, this infrastructure, which has been given to us with these booby traps installed. We're going to create our own. And this sounds like pie in the sky stuff to people until they start to realize the infrastructure, the alternative infrastructure is already there. The technology to create our own networks is already there. There's already an app called Open Garden that you can go online and you can download. It's a mesh Wi-Fi network, so it doesn't require internet at all. It's just people basically interlocking and sharing their network with anyone around them who's part of that network. There's already 5 million users. If that was 50 million, if it was 500 million, we would suddenly have the ability to completely bypass large sections of the internet without ever having to go online. We'd just be a part of a Wi-Fi network. And that's the type of exciting thing that is possible and is going on, but is never going to be reported on by the power structure that relies on us believing that we need this network, these networks supplied to us by these telecoms, ruled over by these FCC overlords, because that's the only imaginable structure for making this work. When in reality, everything relies on us, the average person who is the one who gets to determine this simply by deciding to use this or that technology or not use this or that technology, to participate in this or that community garden or not participate in that this or that community garden, to support local business or not support local business, to use alternative currencies or not use alternative currencies. The choice always ends up with us, but we've been engineered to believe that the system is the only thing that we can rely on and we have to just go along with whatever they've put in front of us. And that's the fundamental lie that needs to be confronted. And there are so many examples of that happening around the world that I really hope the alt media will start making more of an effort to show to other people.
Now, James, just to play devil's advocate with that, and I understand what you're saying, but many will say that's fine. But even if we pursue those types of initiatives, the powers to be are going to shut it down. So what does the resistance look like then if you try to go to something that's more open, away from the technology that they are trying to convince us that it's the only thing available and this is what you need to use? And we say, no, we have an alternative, but they go to shut that alternative down. How do you see that playing out?
Well, it's interesting that this type of feedback I always get from people whenever I talk about this. I always get emails to that effect. Well, they're just going to come in with their goons and their guns, and they're going to try to shut down the community garden or what have you. And that's true. And we've seen that. In fact, we've seen municipalities trying to set laws that people can't collect rainwater, that it's actually illegal to collect rainwater, and just ridiculous things like this. But I think one of the things that is the most insidious part about this entire system is not that it's tyrannical, it's that people don't even consciously accept the fact that it's tyrannical. People do not consciously realize when tyranny is being applied to them, because to a large extent they've been engineered to just accept the system as it is and to think, well, the only way to counteract that is to work within the confines of the system itself. And again, what one of the things that I want to show is, I mean, it would be infinitely preferable to me if there was a boots on the ground, guns in your face tyranny trying to stop people from doing things like setting up a community garden or what have you, because that's the type of tyranny that lets you know that what you're doing is powerful and important resistance. When that doesn't exist, when everybody just kind of goes along with the system and there's a few people here and there that might try something different, and maybe they'll get raided if they're trying to sell raw milk or something like that, so here and there, and no one will really stick up for them because no one really talks about it in the alt media because they're all concentrating on the latest mass shooting or what have you. When that happens, then people will just sort of go along with the system, and it will continue to grow because, again, people are feeding into it each and every day by buying the goods in the supermarket or buying the internet networking from the telecoms companies or what have you. What I want to see is the creation of communities of alternative infrastructures that arise. And yes, I'm sure they will be aggressed upon at some point, but that aggression against those communities will be like the canary in the coal mine and will be the wake-up call for a lot of people who don't believe that this is effective resistance. And I ask, what is the alternative then? So the alternative is simply to continue buying into the infrastructure that exists because, well, they might come after us if we don't. Well, that's exactly the point. And that's exactly why I resist the structures that exist, is because they want us to basically have that gun to our head. But right now it's an implied gun. It's a threat of violence. And if it becomes overt, and if it becomes the gun out there in full broad daylight, I think we'll have a lot more people on our side, and it will be a lot clearer which side people fall on, whether they want to support the right of people to peacefully and voluntarily interact in communities of interest, or if they're on the side of the goons and thugs that'll come in and try to shut that down. And it'll become very apparent. And they say that the best way to defeat a tyrant is to make him act like one. So I say, bring it on.
That's a very good point. And I just, to stay on a thread of technology, you mentioned Snowden real quick. And is he the real deal in your opinion, or is he a player?
I say a player. And I've been looking at this since it broke, I've been looking at this carefully. And I've been saying for quite a while now that Greenwald is clearly not on the level, and he's clearly playing games, and he's clearly monetizing the cash, and he's become the leak keeper who gets to decide what gets released and when, and he's already admitted he's holding the best for last kind of thing, and all of this, and you know, signed with Sony Pictures, the very same producers who produced Zero Dark 30, who he excoriated excoriated for producing hagiography of the war on terror police state and all of this. And now suddenly he writes statements, I'm happy to be working with these people, because of course they're paying him large amounts of money for the story and all of this. So for a long time I've been saying Greenwald is definitely a shady character in this, and his hooking up with Omidyar, who through the Omidyar Network helped to fund what's happening in Ukraine, and all of this just continues to add on. It becomes almost ridiculous at a certain point. But Snowden, I've reserved judgment on for a long time, because there is the possibility that maybe this was a genuine whistleblower and he's just being used. But he's had more than enough opportunity at this point to put anything out on the table towards saying that what's happening and what's going on as a result of these quote unquote revelations, which aren't revelations at all, as I'm sure a lot of people have heard, all of these things that have been pointed out have already been pointed out by other NSA whistleblowers in the past, including Russ Tice, who right. I think made some incredibly important whistleblowing revelations around the time of Snowden's coming out, who has been almost completely ignored, which maybe we can talk about further. But Snowden has had certainly his opportunity to say if he's uncomfortable with any aspect of what's going on. And not only has he not said that, he's actually confirmed that he 100% agrees with what's happening. And he's actually said that his entire purpose was not to change society. It was to allow society the chance to change itself. Which, of course, we see is happening now, because we've got this congressional bill that's in the process of being passed, that apparently is going to let the NSA, is basically going to hardwire into and codify into law the fact that the NSA is spying on people, and they're just going to start to make it more and more legal what's already been done, exactly the way they were caught out with the illegal wiretapping and the telecom scandal, and they just gave all the telecoms immunity and retroactively said everything they did was okay. Because again, people who think that laws are somehow going to solve this seem to be living in an alternate universe where these people are actually abiding by any laws. They have clearly and on the record and in our faces violated the laws that already existed, and the fundamental law of the United States, the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment and all of that. They've fundamentally violated these, flagrantly so, and lied about it, as Bush did when he said that the illegal wiretapping program wasn't happening. And we know that this has been going on. So the idea that laws are somehow going to solve this is, again, I think, just the height of absurdity. And Snowden himself, again, is not only a part of this, he's a willing participant in what's happening. And now he's getting on, you know, NBC or whatever it is, talking to Brian Williams and being lauded and being put on the boards of these free press foundations that are loaded up with George Soros stooges. And all of this is going on right now. And I think it just absolutely stinks to high heaven, and I can't believe that anyone is actually taking this as seriously as they are. But I think one of the expert things that the mainstream media did in framing all of this was to frame it as this whistleblower or traitor discussion, which I think puts it completely in the wrong context and makes people knee-jerk, anyone who's against the state and what they're doing, knee-jerk say, well, he's a whistleblower, he's a hero. And it becomes yet again another binary, because they love to present us with binaries. Either this guy's a traitor or he's a hero. Which is he? Well, what if I think it's more nuanced than that? What if he's actually a spy, and he's been a spy since the beginning, and his entire career screams the fact that he's been an undercover operative, flunking out of special forces and then getting into the CIA, where he's posted undercover at the Swiss embassy, and then he ends up working security at the NSA, and then he ends up working for the NSA, and then he works at this contractor where he's this sysadmin who has the access to spy on anyone, including the President of the United States or anyone else he has an email address for, and then he ends up in this big dramatic pursuit to Hong Kong and Russia. He's been a spy the whole time, and now finally he comes out with Brian Williams and says, you know, I've been a spy, I've been an undercover operative the entire time. And again, no one really bats an eyelash at this, because of course he is. Again, just every single aspect of this story it strikes me the wrong way. And I just find the lack of incredulity in the alt media, again, pretty surprising and pretty disturbing, because again, it shows that they have largely accepted the mainstream framing of this in that very simplistic whistleblower, traitor, or hero debate.
So do you believe then that Snowden was rolled out essentially to be conditioning?
Absolutely. I think, I think I'll have to go back and get some exact quotes on this, and I will do so in the near future. But I believe I've been saying this not only since the beginning of the story, but since before Snowden ever came out. I mean, one of the fundamental tenets of what I've been saying over and over is that we are living in the Panopticon. And again, for people who don't know, Panopticon is the idea of a perfect prison that was invented by British philosopher Jeremy Bentham in the late 18th century. And the idea is you can't have a guard for every prisoner, but you can make every prisoner feel like he is being personally scrutinized by a guard simply by having a guard tower in the middle of a circular prison, and you have the sun shining in from the outside, so as shining in towards the tower, so that the prisoners can't see into the guard tower, but the guards can see out into what's happening in the jails, and they can potentially be looking at any particular prisoner at any particular time. The prisoner never knows when he's being looked at, so he always feels like he's being looked at, and he will start to act accordingly. It's a very insidious system because it's based on mental control over people by getting them to believe and internalize that they are being watched at all times. And I think that's the most important part of all of this, is that the U.S. government doesn't even necessarily have the ability or the interest in looking at every single thing that every single person is doing. But if you can make it feel like you can and potentially are being watched at any particular moment, and if they start to reveal that it's not just when you're typing an email to someone, it's not just when you're talking over Skype to someone, I mean, you also have these little computers in your pocket, and yeah, they have cameras, and yes, they can record you too, even when they're not turned on, even when the battery's pulled out, as has been revealed over the last several years. All of these other things, the entire infrastructure of our lives, which is now completely enmeshed in this digital matrix, is watching and listening to everything you say and do everywhere you go, because you are now, once again, willingly participating in that system by literally buying this technology and putting it in your pocket and taking it with you everywhere you go. And, oh yeah, it's watching and listening to everything you do. And I think that's always been a core part of the entire system, is to try to, once again, get people to internalize that idea that they're being watched and listened to. And that can't be done without letting it slip. Oops, oh, did we say that? Oh, we're listening to everything you do. Oh, please stop telling them this. Oh, if only there was some way we could get to this guy. He's single-handedly bringing down the U.S. intelligence apparatus. Oh, if only there was something we could do. And to me, it's just completely the case of the don't throw me in the briar patch. Because, again, I think they want us to understand that we're being watched, and they want us to internalize that. And sadly enough, it's already working, because there was a university study that came out just a few months ago that showed that sensitive keywords, searches for sensitive keywords, were already down in the months since Snowden's revelation. They looked at what keywords were being searched in Google before Snowden and now after Snowden, and they found that there's been I can't remember what percentage, but a significant enough percentage decrease in what they called sensitive terms, not only things like terror or bomb or things of that nature, but even things to do just with personal matters, medical things and things of that nature. So people are already starting to internalize this and already starting to literally change their behavior as a result of it. And in that case, I would say this is mission accomplished.
So basically mass paranoia, mass mind control to a degree. To
keep Unfortunately people
paranoid.
So, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And you mentioned before others that had come before Snowden, and we mentioned, you mentioned Russell Tice and also William Binney. Did you want to talk a little bit about what Russ Tice brought to the table before Snowden ever showed up?
Well, before Snowden ever showed up, Russ Tice was actually one of the sources for the New York Times reporting back in 2005 on the original wiretapping scandal. And for people who remember that story, the Times had been sitting on it for over a year. Since 2004, they'd been sitting on that story because they didn't want to influence the election, apparently, the Bush-Kerry election. So they didn't want to report on the illegal things that the Bush administration had been up to. Yeah, well, that's an interesting editorial decision. Eventually, they were forced to publish that story because one of the authors, one of the co-reporters on that story was coming out with a book, and he was going to reveal it in the book. So the New York Times had to try to get the scoop. So they finally published the story. And when it did, it turned out, yes, the telecom Times had been collaborating with the U.S. government in helping to illegally wiretap people. And again, it was a completely illegal program that was signed off on by Bush administration officials and then granted retroactive immunity. So basically, the Congress passed a law to say, yep, well, it was illegal at the time, but we make it retroactively okay. So people might remember that story, and Russ Tice was one of the sources for it. And then later on, he was, for example, I think it was 2009. It was shortly after Obama got into office that he went on, I believe it was Olbermann, Keith Olbermann's show, and he was talking about how journalists were actually being targeted by the NSA, and they were being spied on. For people who don't know, basically Russell Tice was working in the NSA in the period around the turn of the millennium to mid-2000s, when obviously he was forced out. They tried to put him through some kind of psych evaluation to try to prove he was crazy or something when he was trying to blow the whistle on these types of programs. So he got effectively pushed out of the NSA. And so in 2009, he came out and started to reveal, well, actually, they're also listening to journalists. And now journalists are afraid to report on what's happening in the NSA and the establishment, the intelligence infrastructure, because they know they're going to be targeted. And Olbermann was kind of amazed by this, but he let it drop very quickly, and we never heard about it again. And then a few years later, we start to have these scandals about journalists being spied on for their political reporting. So again, that was already on the table years in advance. And then just around the time of just before Snowden, just about a month or two before Snowden came out, there was a pretty remarkable thing that happened, again, on television. A lot of the biggest secrets are right there out in the open. There was a report that Aaron Burnett of CNN was doing on the Boston bombing investigation and what was happening there. And there was a story where they were discussing the contents of a phone call that not Jokar, the Jokar's brother, the other Tsarnaev.
Yes, yeah, I know who you're speaking of.
Yeah, whose name escapes me. His wife apparently had been involved in some kind of phone conversation, and they were thinking it was a voicemail or something. So they thought, oh, well, maybe there's a record of that. But it was an actual conversation. So someone picked up the phone and they talked. And so they were discussing that and how, well, there's just no way, I guess, we can ever know what they were talking about. And live there on the air, Tim Clemente, who was an FBI agent a former FBI agent who's a kind of security analyst for CNN, yes. He said, well, actually, intelligence agencies in terror investigations can look at what people said in phone calls. And both Aaron Burnett and the other person in that conversation were pretty just amazed to be hearing about this. And it was the first time anything like that had been said on the air. And Russ Tice, when he went on first Boiling Frogs Post and then on my program, he said that when he heard that, he was absolutely flabbergasted, because he had been predicting that this was where things were heading, based on the NSA infrastructure that he knew already existed and what they were constructing in Utah. But when he heard that, he knew that the Utah data center was already operational and they were already recording every phone call. They were all scooping it up completely 100% wholesale. So he met with some of the other NSA whistleblowers who, I don't know the exact list of who was involved, but one could presume it would be the Bill Binneys or the Thomas Drakes or who have you, some of the big names of the NSA whistleblowing community, got together and discussed this, and they managed to piece together what information they had and then this information from Clemente, and they basically pieced it together that, yes, the NSA data center is operational and this is going on. So this all happened just before Snowden came out, and I even did a report on this, the real AP spying scandal or something of that effect, because the scandal at that time was how the AP was being spied on by the government. But I was trying to say, no, the real scandal is they're recording every single phone call and the content of every single phone call. And then a couple months later, who comes out but Edward Snowden with his quote-unquote revelations that they're collecting metadata. And suddenly the entire conversation has been and continues to be, well, they're collecting metadata on U.S. citizens. And yeah, they might be collecting content on a couple of foreign countries, but you know, it's the metadata issue in the United States. No, it's not. It's the metadata and the content. And this has already been admitted. Again, I don't understand why there would be any confusion over this or any debate over it, except for the fact that they want to obscure what has already been admitted. And they've done an exceptionally effective job about this because, again, Edward Snowden and his quote-unquote revelations have managed to frame this entire debate with things that we already knew, and not even as much as we already know. And again, this goes back years and years with all sorts of whistleblowers who have already talked at great length about the infrastructure for everything that Snowden's been discussing. Just as one more example, the first big Snowden story was the PRISM story, and how the fact that basically the U.S. government has a way of getting into the data streams of Facebook and Yahoo and all of those major provider or internet giants. And how do they do this? Oh, it's because they have this ability to sort of split off sections of the internet and record all the data that's going through. Again, we already knew that from a whistleblower who came out 10 years ago to blow the whistle on a room in an AT&T data center in San Francisco, that he didn't have access to the room itself, but he had access as sort of janitorial services or something of that sort in the AT&T. He had access to what lines were running into that room, which was being operated by the NSA, and it was basically a split of the entire internet data trunk of what all the information that was coming into AT&T was going into that room. So, and we knew that from some of the materials that had been ordered in there, we knew they had these NARIS devices, which were specifically for capturing unbelievably large amounts of data. And so we knew that they were splitting off the internet trunk and recording this data as much as 10 years ago. And now Snowden's coming out to start to, you know, give tiny little drips and drabs of it. And now, as opposed to the whistleblowers 10 years ago, now this is mainstream news and they're reporting breathlessly as if we're hearing this for the first time. And again, my question, what's the agenda? Why is this suddenly news that can and should be reported? And why is it not going as far as we already know the data and the information goes?
And what's unfortunate, James, is that they, with Snowden, they are taking a poll or taking a pulse, and most people don't even care. I mean, let's just say that Snowden wasn't conditioning. Let's just say he was the real deal. The fact that he came out with these revelations, and it was so broadly broadcasted, unlike Russ Tice or Bill Binney, which were essentially suppressed, Snowden's revelations were put out there, and they were in all the major newspapers after The Guardian put their articles out, and most people, they just shrugged their shoulders.
100% agree. I completely agree with that. That is the real travesty of all of this. Because again, yes, they can be letting some of this information out for whatever purposes they want to do that. But the real question, again, is how do we react to this? Because again, I really do think it comes back down to the level of us as individuals who, again, hold all the power in this system, if only we understand that we hold the power. And exactly right. If we just sit there and just, well, you know, what are you going to do? Shrug your shoulders and go on with life as usual, except using less sensitive search terms, then they've won. They've completely won. Again, no matter whether this is a psyop or whether it's completely 100% square or whatever it is, the real question is how we react to this. And I think part of that is because people, even the people who are concerned about this and realize something is wrong, which most people do, down if you get people in one-on-one conversations and you get them really talking about the structure and the system that exists, most people will eventually come to the point where, yes, they don't agree with what's going on, but what you going to do about it? And I've had that conversation many times. And that, I think, is really the most effective piece of conditioning that we've been led to believe at all. And again, this goes back to what the alt media can do if they capture the sort of momentum that we have right now to start steering people towards positive ideas of what people can do, because so many people are just disheartened by the fact, nothing you can do. They continue to do it. No matter what, who we vote for or what initiative we support, they just continue doing this stuff. So, you know, might as well just go on with your life and stop worrying about it. And I that's, of course, completely the wrong message to be taking away from this. What we could be doing, of course, is supporting things like not only what I was talking about earlier with the pirate internet, but how about really practical things that could have an immediate effect on what's happening right now? Like if Utah passed the Nullify the NSA bill that has been proposed by the Nullify NSA campaign at offnow.org, which would stop all state material support to the NSA including selling water to the data center to cool the computers. Again, people think that this is some sort of magical, mystical thing that runs on Illuminati special, you know, magical powers from the 10th dimension or something. These are computers. They're computers. They need this water for cooling systems. They need that the infrastructure. They need these things in order to run. And this isn't, you know, black science or something. This is just out and out reality. And again, if we can shut off those things, yes, then maybe whatever. People have said, oh, if you do that, well, then they're just going to start helicoptering water into the, you know, from another state or something. And all of these things have been proposed. Again, the point is to make these tyrants act like the ridiculous sci-fi cartoon character tyranny that they are. And if people don't even want to take that one step to challenge what's going on, then we really have lost. Because ultimately, this is not a battle for any particular resource. It's not a battle for in order to get more money or anything of that source. It is a battle for our hearts and minds, to use that phrase. It is a battle for our consciousness. It is a battle to get us to sit down and take it when they do whatever they want to do. And we've already come so far along that they can outright plunder trillions of dollars from the American economy out in the open without even hiding it. They can completely spy on people 100% illegally out in the open. They're not even hiding it anymore. They can do all of this. They can kill American citizens without trial, without anything. There's a presidential assassination list out in the open. They're not hiding it. And people are doing nothing. And that is the real problem. And again, I don't think it's an insoluble problem, but it's a problem that the alt media should be directing all of its resources and energy towards diverting and to doing something about, rather than just dissecting the propaganda that they're throwing at us.
Do you think, James, that what happened at the Bundy Ranch is an example of revealing and exposing this tyranny for what it is? In other words, some people will look at the Bundy Ranch situation and say, look, they sent the goon squad out there. You had the BLM, all their armored vehicles, their automatic weapons, and so on. And that came to a standstill and dissipated. One could argue, perhaps your argument, that it went the way it did because they did not want to be exposed. Otherwise, they would look like the tyrants that they are.
Well, there are a lot of different ideas that we can take from the Bundy Ranch situation, but I think that has to be one of them. The reason that ended the way that it did was because there was that incredible wave of support that we saw from, you know, a lot of different people, and we saw people coming from across the country to help out with that situation. And that's the type of thing I would like to be seeing, not as some bizarre random thing that happens just, you know, because it gained some viral attention on the internet, but more as a par for the course, more as a part of the way that we operate within our communities and with the people that we appreciate and the people that we interact with on a daily basis. And that's why I think so much attention has been focused for decades, for generations now, in trying to pick apart communities, to try to get people away from the idea that they are in a community with, you know, with neighbors, with people that they actually see and interact with on a daily basis. Now people are more and more interacting, if at all, they are interacting online with people they've never met and likely never will in far off lands. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's important. I think that's overall a good thing as well. But we have to remember that we are living in communities that, if and when, you know, the real feces hits the fan and things really start to fall apart, it is going to be the people who around you and your community or lack thereof that is going to be the real deciding point in terms of what you're able to accomplish. And I think that really the real resistance has to start in those community structures. And that's why I'm a big proponent of community alternative currencies and farmers markets and ways to trade and interact with people on that individual level. At, you know, face to face, down at the community level. Because again, it's not necessarily that this or that farmer's market is going to solve the world's problems or is going to completely 100% provide for all your food or anything of that sort, but that those community structures are the things that can and will hopefully survive whatever type of economic collapse is coming. And again, that's not speculation. That's something that we've seen For example, in Greece, when they've had their economic calamity in the last several years, and one of the ways that they've been getting through that is through a community alternative currency infrastructure called the Volos system, a type of trading system, which, again, it's great to create that after the fact and after the collapse has happened, but it would be a lot more beneficial if that was already functioning and in place before that collapse happened. And the best part about it is, even if the collapse never happens, then what you have is a vibrant, healthy local community that trades and supports and interacts with each other. And there is nothing wrong with that. It is not a win-lose situation. It is a win-win situation, no matter what happens. And that, I think, has to be a more fundamental message, not only to my work, but hopefully to the work of others, that at the end of the day, it's what we are able to accomplish together that is the important part in all of this, not what we wait to have happen to us, because there's nothing we can do about it. And it's fundamentally that mindset that there is something that we can affect in this world, rather than just simply being passive recipients of whatever's coming down the pike.
Now, James, to switch gears a little bit, and I want to jump into something here that I know you know a lot about, and that's about the BRICS versus the dollar situation, where it certainly appears to be an outcome that Russia is determined to push forward. And I was wondering if you could just give us your insights on what that means to the U.S.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that are happening, and they're happening fairly quickly in terms of geopolitical situation. But I suppose that's to be expected. I mean, when you look back at history, ever since the Romans a couple of thousand years ago, there have been international reserve currencies of one sort or another. I mean, there's been the Roman denarii or whatever it is. The dominant geopolitical power empire of this or that age has generally determined what the international reserve currency might be. So you go up through the Portuguese and the Dutch and the French and the British, and you arrive at the age of the American empire. And of course, it's the U.S. dollar that is the international reserve currency. And basically what this means is the U.S. dollar is by far and away the most used currency in the world. It's used for the settlement of international accounts. Basically, every central bank in the world needs a big stock of U.S. dollar or U.S. dollar denominated assets like treasuries or what have you, in order to be able to cover shorts and trade deficits and things of that nature. So basically, the dollar is in constant demand and has been for, at the very least, half a century, since the Bretton Woods was instituted in the 1940s. But what we're seeing is the beginning of the ending of that system. And I think probably with every such ending of any system, it's telegraphed well in advance for those who are willing to look for the signs of that. But very few people are, because they just imagine that, this is just so monolithic. How could we imagine anything different? As if the U.S. dollar will forever and always be the reserve currency for the world. But what we're seeing are signs that there are countries that are starting to buck the trend. And it's difficult for countries that are bucking the trend of something like the US dollar reserve system to buck that trend, specifically because the first countries to do it will suffer from doing it. If you have, like China does, $1 trillion or so in US treasuries, and you try to dump those treasuries all at once, obviously you're going to lose all of that that money, that notional value that you have, is going to be completely disappeared because of your dumping. So, I mean, at a certain point, either this is going to happen as a domino, and basically it's going to happen very quickly, or it's not going to happen at all. And I think it's starting to happen, that countries are starting to move away from the U.S. dollar infrastructure. And there was a lot of talk in recent months about the Gazprom/China CNPC deal to run pipelines down from Russia to China that's going to estimated be worth $400 billion over the lifetime of the contract in the coming 20 years or so. Now, no one really knows the details of the contract because, again, they didn't release it. But again, it's being estimated at $400 billion. And people, including myself, were talking about the possibility, if this contract was denominated not in U.S. dollars, but in ruble or in yuan, well, suddenly you would have a significant chunk of export change being denominated not in U.S. dollars, going around the U.S. dollar reserve system, which would be a significant step. I mean, again, $400 billion over 25 years is nothing in the bigger scheme of things. But a symbolic gesture or as a gesture of things to come in terms of future agreements, it would have been a very, very important gesture. But as we now learn, in fact, this deal is being denominated in dollars because the trade accounts of China and Russia and other countries are more and more using local currencies like rubles. But the export accounts are still denominated in dollars, and they're now starting to change over that financial infrastructure. And we just saw China signing a deal with Russia's second largest bank to denominate some export accounts in local currencies. But it's a slow process to wean themselves off this international infrastructure where basically all the banking details and everything goes through Wall Street at one point or another. At some point, it's all coming back through Wall Street or going to Wall Street. And so much of these accounts and banks have correspondent banks in Wall Street or in the U.S. financial system that it's extremely difficult to disentangle all of this. But the point is that the work is now being done to do that. And one of the structures that has been proposed and is still on the drawing board, but they're still continuing to hammer away at it, is this BRICS Development Bank, which they envision is going to be kind of an alternative to the World Bank in terms of providing development funds to third world and developing countries. And this is going to supposedly be capitalized by the BRICS, and the $10 billion capitalization number has been thrown around that is supposedly going to be evenly divided between all five participants, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Now, again, this hasn't been finalized, so it's still speculative at this point. But if and when that structure gets put in place, I think, again, that's going to be a significant step along the way towards ditching the U.S. dollar hegemony and also the U.S. infrastructure, because, of course, the World Bank and IMF are just outgrowths of the Anglo-American establishment and have been used as such to get countries trapped into debt slavery and to, well, the World Bank helps them create the infrastructure and the IMF then takes it over for the Western oligopolical interests. So it's a really insidious system that's been created. And now we have this idea that the BRICS supposedly are going to start their own and presumably act more like, for example, China does in Africa, which is to say they don't care at all about the politics of whatever country they're interacting with. All they care about is getting X, Y, or Z resource. So they will sign whatever contract will facilitate that. And they'll help create the infrastructure. They'll give infrastructure development grants and they'll take the resources. And one could imagine that would be more the way that the BRICS Development Bank would work. And again, would be a significant alternative for a lot of developing countries, especially ones that find themselves in the crosshairs of the Anglo-American establishment, which is increasingly trying to find its foothold and toehold into Africa, which is why we keep seeing these stories about Boko Haram or Kony or whatever the boogeyman of next week is. And a lot of them, by the way, supported with infrastructure provided by the U.S. So that's just another part of the modus operandi. So I think, again, there's so many different fronts on which this is happening, but perhaps one of the most important right now is the Sino-Saudi relationship that's developing, where the Saudi government is getting cozier and cozier with China. And now they're starting to talk about different ways that they can cooperate. And there's people floating the idea that China is going to be that Saudi Arabia is going to be providing alternative access to funds for China and others. Rather than U.S. treasuries, they're going to be providing gold-denominated oil deals and that type of thing. And again, this is something that would have been unthinkable just a few years ago. But now we're seeing that China has become the largest importer of oil in the world, overtaking the U.S. And we see Saudi Arabia starting to distance itself from the American umbrella that it's been under for the last 40 or 50 years under the petrodollar hegemon. So some significant changes are taking place right now. And at the end of the day, what this means for the U.S. and the U.S. economy is that a country that has enjoyed the ability to print as much money as it likes whenever it needs it for any reason that it wants and has been doing so gleefully since Nixon ended the gold standard in the 1970s, is suddenly going to find, well, actually, people aren't going to be able to or aren't going to want to cash the checks that we write. They're not going to want to buy our IOUs. And we can use the Federal Reserve to basically monetize the debt. But that might keep the internal domestic economy going. But when you start trying to buy things outside of the country in a currency that is less and less being accepted as the international reserve, it's going to be harder and harder to do so. And that reflects poorly on a country that has outsourced so much of its productive economic capacity over the past 30 or 40 years in this deliberate attempt to move so much of this productive activity off to China and whatever, you know, other developing countries out there, so that now America really does depend on cheap Chinese slave goods in order to keep the economy even at a standard of living comparable to what it was 20 or 30 years ago, although we're already seeing declines in living standards in the United States. So I think that process would hasten, and if the US dollar reserve really did collapse and was replaced by something else, I think we'd see basically the US economy as we know it would collapse, and the ability of the US, for example, to act as the imperial hegemon around the world and to send its troops wherever it wants for whatever length of time it wants in to occupy whatever countries it wants would come to an end, which again would have a pretty significant effect on the US's ability to project its power around the world. So we're on the cusp of a completely different world order, as the operative phrase might be, and it's a scary time, precisely because these times of economic instability, of course, will hurt the average person first and foremost. I mean, the oligopolistic interests at the top are already well secure and already have a lot of their investments offshore in Dubai or wherever else they're parking their money. So don't worry about them. It's the average person who's going to suffer the most in all of this. And that's what I worry about. And that's why I'm interested in promoting the alternatives and the alternative currencies and the alternative community infrastructures that, again, will hopefully survive these types of collapse scenarios.
So, James, I know I want to be respectful of your time, but just one last follow-up question here. When you talk about a collapse, are we talking about useless fiat dollars and hyperinflation? Is that what we're talking about? Or is there a possibility that the United States would then go back to a gold and silver standard to back their money?
I suppose that's possible, but I find that extremely unlikely. I think that the way that they're attempting to collapse this is more in the vein of trying to basically use this as a springboard or a catapult to launching more regional infrastructure, regional governments. So I think that if and when this collapse happens, this financial collapse happens, and the U.S. suddenly finds itself in a position where it can't just print whatever debt it wants and sell it to the rest of the world, I think that would be used as the excuse to facilitate and to hasten the creation of some sort of North American banking and financial community. And of course, there would be all sorts of, you know, security and infrastructure wedding that would go on during that process as well, as they try to lump everything together. And that would also hasten the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal and its Atlantic counterpart, because of course we all know that free trade is the answer to any economic ill. I think that they would just use that as the green light to put the rest of their global government agenda in hyperdrive. And ultimately, what we'd be looking at, more likely than a gold or silver-backed currency, I think we would be looking at the floating of the Amero or whatever the equivalent of some sort of regional currency. And ultimately, of course, for that to be wedded into a global economic infrastructure. And in fact, we might see the start of that process as early as the end of this year, the beginning of next year, which is when the IMF is apparently going to be holding its next meeting on its special drawing rights, which is a type of currency, I guess, that the IMF issues, which can be used by central banks in their reserve holdings, rather than holding specifically dollars or specifically euros or specifically yen. If they have these IMF special drawing rights, that entitles them to draw euros or yen or dollars. There's a couple of others in that basket, but basically four or five of the major currencies in the world. But at the end of this year, the beginning of next year, every 5 years, the IMF reevaluates what currencies are included in that basket of currencies. And China, for one, has been openly angling since the 2008 crisis to be included in that basket. And they've been working, I think, feverishly in the years since then to create a large enough banking infrastructure and one that is backed up by more significant amounts of gold to angle themselves to be put in that basket. So that might be another one of the nails in the coffin of the US dollar reserve system if the SDR, the special drawing rights system, becomes more bolstered, more strengthened. I think that would be more likely to be posed as an alternative than, for example, going back to a gold or silver-backed currency, which I don't think that the power structure wants to happen, or I don't think they will allow that to happen.
I suspect you're absolutely right. Well, James, we are pushing up against the end of the hour, and I was wondering if you'd like to share with our listeners how to catch up with your podcasts and your interviews?
Absolutely. Well, people who are interested can always check CorbettReport.com. That's CorbettReport.com, and there you'll find my my audio, my podcasts, my interviews, my videos, my articles, all of that completely available for free download. Also links to all of the other sites that I work with, like Boiling Frogs Post and Global Research, and my other website, FukushimaUpdate.com. So lots of information there at CorbettReport.com. And of course, if people want to support my work, once they've had a chance to take a look at it and decide that they do want to support it, you can always sign up for a subscription or purchase a DVD there to help me out.
Well, James, thank you so much for connecting. I want to say it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show, and I'd love to have you come back at a later date, if you're up to that, to share more of your insights and perspectives. Really, this has been a fantastic discussion.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. And that concludes my interview with James Corbett, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as I did. James's website can be found at www.corbettreport.com. And as always, I would like to thank everyone for listening and visiting the blog, The Sage of Quay. Also, you can take a listen to my album, Leaving Dystopia, by heading to laborofloveMusic.com. And remember, live in truth and always serve creation. It's really that simple. See everyone next week. Be safe and joy, and God bless.